Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this.
Without me. I'm your host, Dr. Market Culture Vulture. The number to call to hop on this line, and I dare you to call me, is 646-478-4847. That's 646-478-4847. As we just kind of wheel through the universe here, as the Mets are trying to land a 2-1 victory here, Takahashi walking the ballpark. Here comes Jerry going to the bullpen. He's going for who? Acosta? Oh, this is a nightmare. Anyway, I started last week with a Mets rant. I can't do that again to you guys, but I'll keep you posted. I have my eye on you. There's so much going on, though, and, you know, like I said, if you've heard the preview of the show, is that, you know, we've been kind of, you know, pinging people every week, getting them on, talking about the future, trying to figure out, because the summer kind of is that kind of vibe for me, you know? The winter, you're just coping with the present and dealing a lot with, you know, nostalgia with the holidays, and you kind of just, you know, you scrape your way through the winter, and the spring you go out and you kind of get into stuff and things are new again. You get to the summer, you're going, what the hell are we doing? What the hell are we doing with our lives? And I looked around today, and I'm like, people are freaking losing it. All right? So I don't even know where to start. Let's just see. I have a, you know, if you listen to last week's show on mind control, we're all basically going hell in a handbasket anyway. But I'm going to start with this dude up in Brewster, Massachusetts, Ron Zvedin. His lung had a tumor, but on closer look, there was something else. There's a little clip that I think you'll enjoy, and that'll start the proceedings.
I was told that I had a pea seed in my lung that had split and had sprouted.
It was not the diagnosis Ron Zvedin was expecting. He had prepared himself to hear the words cancer and tumor, but a plant growing in his lung?
Probably about a half an inch, and that's a pretty big thing.
Ron had been sick for months. He was already fighting emphysema when his health took a turn for the worse.
I was not doing too well. A lot of coughing. I was very listless.
On Memorial Day, Ron's wife called 911, and he was rushed to the hospital where doctors took these x-rays and found his left lung collapsed. For 2 weeks, they ran tons of tests, but they all came back negative for cancer, until one doctor found the plant growing in his lung.
Whether this would have gone full term and I'd be working for the Jolly Green Giant, I don't know. But I think the thing that finally dawned on me is that it wasn't cancer.
Ron says he never felt anything growing in his chest, just a lot of coughing. Doctors suspect he had eaten a pea at some point in the last couple of months, and it went down the wrong way and then began to grow.
One of the first meals I had in the hospital after the surgery had peas for the vegetable.
You gotta laugh yourself?
I laughed myself and ate them.
His wife, Nancy, thrilled with this strange twist of fate.
God has such a sense of humor. I mean, it could have been just nothing, but it had to be a pea, and it had to be sprouting.
All right, so there you go. That starts the news here. Unbelievable. That's unbelievable. You shake your head. And meanwhile, as that's happening, Manny Acosta comes in, as I mentioned before. I'm keeping an eye on this thing. Two outs, two strikes on two straight guys. They walk them. Now Tulowitzki comes up. Two outs, two strikes, Tulowitzki. And the first pitch from Manny Acosta almost took his head off. So now the runners are on second and third. And they're going to walk him, and they got to bring in Feliciano, who hasn't thrown a strike in about a month. Unless they're going to leave Acosta in here. Let's see what's happening here before I go on to this next piece of news. Unbelievable. These Mets, they can't score a run to save their asses. And now Melvin Mora, this fossil, this old Met from 10 years ago, all he has to do is get a little bleeder here. Two outs. You know what? Let's pull over and watch this. The Braves have stolen two games in a row. The Mets are about to just loan one to the Rockies. You can't buy a run on the road. All right, Acosta, strike one. Soma casting live, Flushing, Queens. Mets, tears in their eyes, trying to stay above 500. Meese gives you seven innings of scoreless baseball. You score a lousy two runs in the first inning, and that's it. Kicking the ball around here in the eighth inning. The 0-1 to Mora. Strike two at the letters. Dun, dun, dun. Might get a call in from our friend Mike Silva here to see if he has any news. I don't see anything yet, but on this Ollie Pete start on Saturday, that I almost had like a dry heave when I was walking down the hall and I heard it on the radio before, against Holiday on Saturday. Okay, for the third straight time, we have two strikes on someone with two outs, and his name isn't Tulowitzki. It's Melvin freaking Mora. Strike the bum out! And it's ball one. High and outside. So we're going to have our astrologer friend from the West Coast, Dr. Craig Martin, joining us at 9:30. Try to put some of this stuff in perspective. I got a couple more items of news here as soon as we see what happens here in this eighth inning. Acosta, the 1-2, he winds and fires. Fouled away. What the frick is that? My computer has a mind of its own tonight. It's like there's more pop-up ads and things. I don't even know what the hell it's doing. Anyway. Acosta again, the 1-2 pitch. He leans in to get the sign from Blanco. Okay, see if he throws one out of the strike zone. Kicks and fires. Outside, 2-2. Now he has to make a pitch. That's not a waste pitch, folks. After he threw the ball at Tulowitzki's head, the first pitch he threw to put the runners in scoring position. And you got to get out of this inning. You got to get out of this inning. Oh. Make your out pitch if you got one. Melvin Mora, a wily veteran. Game matters to no one. Here's the pitch. And he golfs one deep to left. Way back in the corner. Gone. A grand slam. That's all you got to know about those Mets. That's all you got to know, folks. And this is why I have this.
Bag of bad news. And a broken heart.
Now, what I don't understand with Jerry, this moron manager that we have to suffer through for another 40 games or so, is that he just anointed Takahashi the eighth inning pitcher. He just anointed him. Two nights ago, maybe it was last night, you're going to be my eighth inning guy. And he let up a scratch hit, and he let it, you know, to Todd Helton, you know, line drive single to right, and he let up a little scratch hit to left, and he takes him out. That why couldn't Takahashi pitch to this guy? Melvin Moore on a 2-2 pitch. Jacks went out, and now the Mets are down by 3 runs. They've given up so many grand slams, it's blinding. I think that's a 10th one, maybe the 11th one. I don't know. But it's just beyond pathetic. Beyond pathetic. Hey, it's like he won the lottery over there. A crushing defeat. Once again, the Mets ripping my lungs out. How many games have they lost on the air this year? Oh, my God. And for the Mets.
Boozy, boozy, bop. City bop.
All right. Man, I'm Takahashi's sitting there with his arms folded like, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. He brings in Acosta. He almost takes Takahashi's head off, and then he lets up a grand slam. What are we doing? What are we doing with this manager? He's horrible. Oh, my God. All right, so let's get back to our news here. Let's see what I did with it. All right. Then he walks the next guy. Oh, yeah. And now Manuel goes to sleep. He won't even take him out. The guy will be in there. It'll be 11-2. That's what I love about Manuel. Once it goes wrong, oh, the phone works. The bullpen, look. I can't. It's oh, God. This is so bad. I don't know who's going to win when they play Houston this week because both our bullpens stink so bad. Games might last 3 hours after the seventh inning. Anyway, yeah, I'm sure you guys have seen this story. Mr. Slater here, our friend from JetBlue, who quit his job, at Steven Slater, in a most unique way, as Acosta lets up a single to right. And maybe Jerry go out and get him now. He's almost hit a guy, gave him a grand slam, and gave him 2 more hits. Maybe you get him out? Maybe. No. Jerry's staring into space. Mets have not won 2 consecutive games since June 22nd and 23rd. Now they have 6 outs. They're down by 3 runs. Maybe Jerry can send the pitching coach out. God, he's terrible. Anyway, he's been hailed as a hero, this Steven Slater guy. And, you know, I don't know if he can handle the pressure. He's going to be famous, apparently. So let's see what TMZ's dug up on this guy, because I'm sure there's going to be lots of fur flying over what he pulled, if you didn't see it. Absolutely. I mean, a classic, almost a sitcom exit where he takes a beer and he slides off the plane. God, if I could quit my job that way. Hello. Oh, these Mets. I'm still looking up at the TV like, you got to be kidding me here. 5-2. They still got him in there. This is 3 batters after the home run. We don't need to hear the commercial. Shut up with your commercials. All right. Let's see what we got here for Mr. Slater. Nope. Pokes at the left. That's going to drop. Here comes another run. Jerry, you're a cruel, cruel, cruel manager. You are a cruel man. To leave that guy in there after that grand slam, he obviously doesn't. Now comes Jerry. Wait a minute. Stop the works. I got to hear the booing. Four runs with 2 outs. Five. Last Friday it was 6 in the 8th. He makes this an issue. He makes it an issue. Why couldn't Nice pitch the 8th inning? Why is he sitting him down? The guy had a freaking 1 run he gave up, I think. Oh, Takahashi's my 8th inning guy. Until he gives up 2 hits, then I panic and I bring in Acosta and I give up 5 runs. Fire him! Please! For the love of Jesus! All right, back to Steven Slater.
Something I had no idea was going on out there. Any regrets?
All right. A little clip from Steven Slater. You know, who knows what's going to go on with that. Let's see if there's anything more here. Here he's getting released from jail. I love the TMZ. Here he comes walking. See Stephen Slater's walking. Oh, well, we've got to talk to him.
What happened on the plane, Stephen?
I can say anything at all.
Stephen, has there been a Nordale in there for you?
What do you say to that? Well, I'm so supportive.
Greatly appreciated.
Stephen, was it a Nordale good to be in jail for the first time? You don't have any record. You're not a criminal. How does it feel?
TMZ has footage of a man running for his life from cameras. This is news. This is the culture, guys. He's buzzworthy. He's a buzzworthy dude. It's all over the news. JetBlue. JetBlue makes news all the time for all the right things, right? Stranding people in the airport for 8 hours. Dudes sliding out of the plane with beers. Oh, God. Can't make it up. There you go, dun dun dun. Shut up with the dun dun dun. Not sure what that is. All right. A couple days ago, I spotted this. It was in Turkey. Again, signs that the world is ending soon, or it should, or we should just end this inning with the Mets, down 6-2 now. Luciano coming in to put the finishing touches on it. It's like watching that Braves game today. They give up the lead in the ninth inning, and then they score 6 runs in the top of the tenth to win 8-2. Let's see, murder at wedding. Yeah, it was over in Turkey. I don't know if I spelled. Okay, let's see. Let's snag it. All right. And it's a tradition, apparently, in Turkey that the groom fires a weapon at to celebrate being married, and he killed his father and his two aunts and injured a bunch of other people. Let's see if there's any more in the news here. Here's a ground ball, and the Mets are out of it, down by 4. Up by 1 to start the inning, and down by 4 to leave it. Unbelievable. That's the Mets. Melvin Moore has bounced all over the league. We never got him back. This guy is a player, and someone always rises up against the Mets. It has like their moment for the season. Jeez, they can't win 2 in a row to save their lives. Because Jerry cannot get through the eighth inning without having some type of a therapy session. You're my man. No, you're my man. No, you're my man. No, you're my man. Oh, he's so bad. So bad. Now, let's see if there's anything about this. Turkey wedding massacre defendants plead guilty. Well, they should. I don't know if this is the right story yet. I want to get this. It was a murder at a wedding. That's a massacre. I don't want a massacre. Come on. Now the computer's doing what it normally does. No, Mark, you don't get to read the story. Now, this is a different wedding. There were 44 people killed at this wedding. That's not my wedding. Murder at wedding. And I got to put AK-47 in. Because that's what went down. You shoot off the weapon, see? And it's like a, hey! Let's see if it goes this way. I know I had it a couple days ago. I didn't save it, though. Murder at wedding. Anyway, the groom, he was firing the weapon, and it was automatic, say, AK-47, and he couldn't control it, and the stray bullet killed part of his family. You know, so I don't know if that means he returned the gifts. I don't know what happens with that, but I just want to read the story before my guest gets here. All right, let's see. Let's go this way. See, this is another example here in summertime. It's all spontaneous. It's all me reading the news, and then it all goes to hell here. Wedding. All right, news. See, they got different categories. Oh, here it is. Turkey groom kills wedding guests. There you go. There's a story that catches your eye. All right. DeGrom lost control of the AK-47 as he tried to fire in traditional celebration in the air. Right? The guest was sprayed with bullets, and the groom's father and two aunts were killed. The groom has been arrested. The three who died succumbed to their wounds in the hospital. Firing into the air is a commonplace celebration in parts of Turkey and has on many occasions led to death and injuries. Turkey has tried to impose harsher penalties but has not ended the practice. And that isn't a sign the world needs to just pull over. I mean, come on. All right, so we have the guy with the pee in his lung. We got Stephen Slater sliding out of planes. We got this other shape picking off his family at the wedding. What's Gaia have to say about this? Oh, Earth, I'm asking you, how do you feel about this? I mean, how do you feel about Jerry's pitching management of the eighth inning there? Let's see. China floods expect to worsen with heavy rain. So it's not bad enough that they're flooding. Now it's raining. And the mudslides have already killed more than 1,000 people, with tens of thousands still at risk. Rescuers in China are bracing potentially more flooding just 72 hours after the country's worst mudslide in decades killed more than 700 people in the northwest Gansu province. Forecasts indicate that more heavy rain is likely. Military and rescue workers are trying to clear debris that is clogging the Baguang River and could create temporary dams, which then burst, sending more water and mud rushing into the already devastated region. More than 1,000 people are unaccounted for, and their prospects look grim. Unlike earthquakes where buildings may collapse, but leave space for survivors, mudslides envelope an area, leaving little hope for those buried beneath the pile. There are a few roads leading into the mountainous region, so it's difficult for rescue workers and supplies to reach the affected area. With hope fading, authorities are trying to stop potential health crises that could result from the flood damage. Reuters reports more than 10,000 troops have been sent to the area. I mean, this is terrible. Have you heard this? I haven't heard anything about this in the news. Could you imagine if anything even remotely like this happened in the United States? It would be the only story. We, you know, we're very oblivious to stuff like this. It's amazing. 30,000 people are trapped in the flood. 30,000. Oh, my God. It's a horrible story. And the government is reacting, and there's going to be inflation as a result. There's $73 million in emergency relief funds. I mean, it's going to affect their economy, which, of course, affects our economy. You know, I feel like getting our friend over there from the Merlin Project on the horn. Who saw this coming? One away in the eighth as Castillo flails in vain. Why is he in the game? I don't know. Why? See, I always think that when I look at the Mets lineup, getting back to my mundane existence, when you see Castillo and you see Beltran in the lineup, it's like having guys that just can't, they're not winning players. So, like Chris Carter here, he's a winning player. Boy. One out, one strike they needed. One lousy, stinking strike. Ugh. Anyway. Heat wave grips the U.S. Midwest through the weekend. Dun, 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 dun. Now, we're into this. Temperatures in the central U.S. are forecast to climb back to the 100-degree mark this week in many areas. Excessive heat warnings have been issued for 9 states along the Mississippi, and heat advisories cover parts of 7 or more of them. In the latest heat wave, there's the latest heat wave of a northern hemisphere summer that has shattered records around the world.
I have a BVM group from my car to the desk.
Do you believe this?
You see a cool car?
I have no idea where this is coming from, folks.
Hey, you know, come check this car out.
Shut up with your car, Ed. I'm trying to talk here. Computer's got a mind of its own. Ugh. Anyway, the buildup of heat will make heat-related illnesses a very real and dangerous threat, especially for those living in unair-conditioned homes and apartments. Oh, this is a genius from the Weather Service bulletin in St. Louis. A dome of high pressure over the middle of the U.S. is helping drive temperatures up, 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 says Tom Kynes from AccuWeather. Places like Omaha and Des Moines, bad enough you live in Omaha or Des Moines, this may be the worst week of the summer. This isn't to say it won't get hot again, but not as prolonged as it will now. Heat deaths. Heat killed an average of 162 people a year from 2000 to 2009, more than hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, and lightning. Natural gas for September delivery fell 13.5 cents. The lower temperatures, will probably linger through the third week of August, thereby producing a dramatic down spike. I don't know what I'm talking about here. Anyway, it's damn hot out there. Damn hot. 17th warmest July on record. Okay. See, what they're trying to do is interpret all this weather, how's it going to affect the economy. So they're talking about cooling degree days and how it's going to affect oil and all that. So we'll get into that with our guest here, I guess. See how all this stuff's going to spin down. So there you go. You got Superbug. You got Stephen Slater sliding down the plane. You got a flood in China. You got a heat wave. And you got a dude at a wedding shooting up his family. And you got the frickin' Mets with one out in the eighth, 2-2. And Chris Carter is about to get punched out here. Let's see. There he goes. Strike three. Tremendous. And what's going on with Philadelphia? End of the seventh, 2-0 Phillies. Wow. What a horrible game. Horrible. It's so you suffer. See, this is what causes me suffering. Not anybody else, but then again. All right, so let's see if we got our guest up here yet. I don't know if he's in here yet. Let's see. I'm so sad. I really wanted to win two in a row. Go into tomorrow afternoon's game with a little hope. There's no hope with this team. You can't, because you got Jerry managing the game. Reyes up for another give up a bat here. So how you guys feeling? 646-478-4847. You know, the reason I paint such a morbid picture tonight is because when you get to this point in the summer, dog days and all that, you start to kind of look around and see, like, well, what's going on around me? What's going on in the world? Because you've been mucking through, whether you're pulling out from a mudslide or you're digging out from 100-degree temperatures in the Midwest or, you know, whatever's going on, or you go to a wedding in Turkey, duck, and you start thinking about, like, well, what is all this leading up to? And so, you know, to try to fly above it a little bit, we get out some different maps this time of the summer. And once in a while, I'll look at the brain. Once in a while, I'll look at some of the other computerized stuff. But tonight, we're going to take a little look at the astrology of it all. Now, last Monday, I guess it was around the beginning of August there, there was a huge solar wind, a big flare, right around the time of the Lunasad, the celebration of the middle of the summer, which actually was the 7th, the cross-quarter point of the season. And, you know, when I look at it from my point of view, like we entered it on Monday, we entered into the new moon for the middle of the summer, which deals with isolation. So if you feel a little separated from things, you feel a little cut off from, you know, relationships and things like that, this is the part of the summer where there's the maximum amount of growth and also the maximum amount of space or just the kind of energy all around you. So everything's at its peak. It's like being at the peak of the roller coaster. You get a good view of the parking lot, but you really got to ride out the whole storm. So that's for that reason alone, you know, you're sort of feeling a little anxious, feeling a little top-heavy, feeling a little bit kind of unsteady. All that fits. And right now it's a Philo week, so you're reaching out to other people because all the energy, all the coherence is coming from your relationships. So you can imagine if you're stressed and everyone around you is feeling the same feelings of being unsupported and kind of a little fogged in, what that would create. Then you add in the fact that the weather is turbulent and you've got floods on one side and you've got heat on the other, you get all this stuff going on. You have to get off the earth at a certain point because you don't feel like, you know, you want to kind of ride out the deal here. So that's why in somatics, you're always able to go to another level of the surroundings. There's always another point of view, another balcony you can go to overlook things. And, you know, I try to teach clients that to be able to give perspective to themselves, no matter how much you're suffering with pain or suffering with a loss or suffering with a difficulty or an obstacle, there's always a course that comes with the obstacle. And sometimes you have to go off that course because the obstacle sometimes is there to keep you on the course. See, some people try to do an obstacle course and stay, you know, go around the obstacles, through the obstacles, and try to fight them. And some people just say, well, I'm just going to sit here until the obstacle gets out of the way, or I'll just bitch and moan while the obstacle stands in my way. And what the summer is asking you to do, because, it's that maximum part of growth, maximum part of expansion, is telling you take another course, try something new. The winter is when you sort of hunker down and go on safe mode. Summer, no. Summer, you're supposed to be born to run. You're supposed to be having a little fun. So, let's see. We've got about a minute or so until he's supposed to call in, so we'll see if we can get a little summertime music here. Yeah, something quick. No. No. Let's try this. I don't know what this is, but... music as we await our guest who's supposed to be calling in any minute here. Dr. Craig Martin from California at LAHealer.com. Want to check him out? He's doing lots of weird stuff. We're going to get into a little bit of his map here. Talk a little bit about love styles. He's into the love style thing. Hopefully cheer me up from these dopey Mets who have once again spit the bit in the eighth inning and for the thousandth time. Unbelievable. Oh, they're so annoying. And they won last night again, 1-0. You know, ho-hum. Every time they win a game, it's like passing a stone. All right, there he is. All right. So joining us from an undisclosed location somewhere west of the Mississippi, Dr. Craig Martin, and here's a quick introduction. Right.
Dr. Mark.
There he is. All right, Dr. For that. So,
awesome.
I'm just hanging by a thread here tonight. So you're responsible for cheering up me and the thousands of listeners who'll be archiving this thing as they lay prostrate on their back listening to the internet radio with an ice pack over their eyes trying to cope with the world. So I just went through a litany of events in the last week. Floods in China, the guy sliding off the plane in JetBlue. The dude with the pea growing in his lung that thought it was cancer,
right,
up in Massachusetts, the heat in Texas, and, of course, the turkey wedding with the AK-47 where the guy killed his family accidentally. So,
right, and the woman who beat the McDonald's worker over her chicken McNuggets.
Yes, I saw that this morning. Now, so you live out in the land of TMZ out there in L.A., where all of this stuff is disseminating 24 hours a day.
Right.
As someone who is... got 1 foot on the ground.
Things of biblical importance.
Yes, of course. I mean, when you go from the woman freaking out about the thing at the McDonald's to the floods in China, you've covered
correct.
It.
Correct.
And, of course,
you know it. Which celebrity just got a DUI?
Who did?
I'm just saying, you know. Which celebrity just got a DUI? 100,000 people just died in China. What's the difference?
Right, exactly. Well, and then they give you the weather right after that.
Correct. We do get a little burned out, I think, that it's about our attention span, and you know, the internet I think is a reflection of our attention span, and the way we can bounce around on the internet from one subject to another and read something and be like, oh, that's this, and then all of a sudden click on another YouTube video that makes us laugh, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, are we becoming almost? It's almost like we're overly sensitive to weird stuff, like people crying at, like, Toy Story and things like that.
Right.
And then we'll be completely nonplussed about, you know, the war and, you know, all kinds of things that are major, like, you know,
right.
Haiti. And it's like we just go on with our life. We're more worried about Tiger Woods, why he shaved off the Fu Manchu.
Right.
And minutia like that. Is that a function of the culture becoming so digital in the way it functions, where we're not really kind of hooked into these things? We kind of go by like crosstown buses, and we don't really associate ourselves with things, or are we just so flooded we can't process it all?
One of the things I think is that, you know, that when we look at enlightenment, right, from a Eastern perspective, it has to do with calming down the mind and getting the mind to focus and not having the mind be scattered, right? That's the purpose of meditation or things like mm-hmm. that, is to be able to filter out the chatter of the mind. And what our culture is actually encouraging is the chatter of the mind. We're encouraging the opposite. We're encouraging a free-roaming, non-reined-in mental process that bounces all around from one topic to another without putting any value on what those thoughts are about. And if you do that, if you encourage your mind to just go wherever it wants to go, of course it's going to go from one thought to the next. It's not going to stay focused on one thought for very long. And everything turns out to have the same value or meaning. If it's sensationalized, if it's anything sensational, it gets the same kind of attention that something that's really actually dramatic and meaningful. So, yeah, you have a lot of people who might be hurt or die in something like a Haitian earthquake, and then you have a guy jump out of an airplane and flip the company and the passengers the bird. Essentially, to the mind, that strikes us as the same thing. It's like, oh, wow, that's sensational. But it doesn't have to filter down into the emotional body really at all.
No, I remember about a month ago, maybe beginning of the summer, there was a couple of incidences in Philadelphia. There were fans running on the field, and they were tasing. They didn't tase the guy. He ran around. Then they tased this one dude, and it was like, you know, it's a little kid. He was like, you know, 17-year-old kid. And the uproar about, I can't believe that they tased this kid in the middle of the field. And then the next night, somebody tried in another stadium, and they didn't tase him. And it's like, you're right. It becomes sort of like we're living in the movie Inception, where it's a stimulus within a stimulus within a stimulus, and
right.
And we're not able to kind of get a response that's full because the wave never ends. So
right.
We're carried away by the riptide of the commentary and sort of the op-ed that goes on with everything that goes by our eyes. And I think most people, because of Facebook and Twitter and being able to walk around with these things in our phones, it's almost like to shut it off or move away from it, there's a social stigma for not being engaged in it. So,
right.
You know, so how do we as cosmic beings, you know, I like to try to remind people that, you know, this is just like a stepping stone. We're actually from up there, not down here.
Yeah, yeah.
They freak out by that one. They still freak out.
Who freaks out by that one?
Well, most of the moos walking around that are, you know, popping.
Yeah, but I'm sure not your listeners. Your listeners.
Well, my listeners,
you know.
My listeners are rare. They're goofy balls, but they have to deal with people at work and you know, their neighbors that still think that, oh, there goes those woos again. They're out of
Well,
again.
We're spiritual beings in the body. I mean, we're
yeah.
more than just a physical, you know, fleshly skeleton walking around. We actually have an energy source, you know, it's like sort of like an invisible battery. That
yeah.
is more of what we are than the body itself, although obviously in the physical world we are the body. So we try to integrate the concept of, you know, I am what I am on the physical plane, and then beyond that, I have a spiritual essence as well. And that spiritual essence is actually more enduring. But the earthly experience seems very real while we're in it.
Well, again, this gets into subjects like I talk about a lot with people, especially when they're suffering with something, like a fever or something like that, that they think
right.
it's never going to end. And when you get to the point where your mortality it kind of overlaps with reality, which is, you know, those are the two loops that we're kind of stuck in, and then you have things like you're talking about, which gets into a deeper sense of identity and a broader sense of your immortality, and all four of those clover leaves open up.
Right.
Which one of those four perspectives gives you the most, advantage? And it's like most people go all the way down. I'm a realist, and they go all the way down to the dirt. And the dirt isn't very entertaining, by the way. But it is solid, and it is consistent, and it does have some very natural laws to it. And it's nice to have, you know, at least a toehold in reality. But it's never that entertaining. So people go and they get a different reality, a parallel reality, maybe even a reality show. You know, they do what they call it. So they enhance it. They try to improve on reality, which they really shouldn't have to. So then what I see happening is they go to the map wall, and they say, well, I want to go to longevity. I want to extend my life. I want to improve my life. I want to rejuvenate. I want to get younger. I want to get younger. I want to live longer. It's like all that attempt to, you know, you guys are out in L.A. are like the kings of it with the cosmetic surgeries and everything. And what's her name? Heidi Montag with the 10 or 15 surgeries in a couple of days, you know?
Right.
You know, all of that to change the outer appearance because the inner world is so screwed up. And then you go to the next level where you start dealing with identity. And people always ask the question, who am I?
Right.
And I always lean in like, okay, tell me a story. Because the who part came from somebody else. Who am I? Well, I'm an Italian-American. Da, 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 I grew up in New York. It becomes this long timeline winding back to some point where someone else filled in the blanks for you. What you are is what I'm interested in. And hardly anyone gives me an answer that doesn't bleed back to a story. So how do you
get people?
Yeah, it's a different angle on things because that gets into immortality. And you said it before, spiritual being, things like that, you know, having a cosmic origin, understanding yourself as an expression of the universe rather than something that's just hurtling through space and trying to breathe really fast and you know, beat everyone in the traffic.
Right.
How do you get people that are so rooted, so socially conditioned to think in terms of reality first, reality's, you know, big, bad, and out to get me, floods and vermin and everything out there, right? And then to go through all those other layers to get to the point where they don't have to go through faith and religious practice and all those other kind of kickstands and you know, sort of little tools, and just accept things on that level that they are timeless, they are eternal, and their body is not them. Their body is an expression of them. That is really, really counterintuitive for most people.
Absolutely. And you asked a question, which is how to get them to realize that without having to process them through religious dogma.
Yeah, stay out of their head.
Quite a big question.
Well, hey, it's 9:42.
You know, I mean, you know,
again,
and I don't mean to be going too Eastern on you because the West has a lot of good information, but the last challenge that the Buddha experienced before he, you know, sort of went back to town after he became enlightened under the tree was that the quote-unquote the devil energy, the darkness came and confronted him and said, wow, you've achieved enlightenment. That's so awesome. Too bad that there are so many people who won't be able to hear your message. And he said, I'll focus on the people who can.
Hmm.
And I think that, for me, that's a beginning point for answering the question that you asked, which is, how do we wake up the people who are sleeping? And the answer is, you only wake up the ones that want to get woken, you
mm-hmm.
know? It brings up an immediate metaphor about, like, trying to wake up kids or wake up a teenager, right, while they're asleep in bed, so they like that. When you're younger, like if the masses of people are sort of like that, it's really difficult to wake up and like go away, I don't want to get up, then you're really not going to be able to. You know, how you do that, I got another image too, which is of course that you can wake up anyone if you promise them that waking up is going to be like Christmas Day or the day that they're getting on an airplane to go to Hawaii. That's another answer for you, is how do you get them to wake up? You tell them that waking up is going to provide them an experience of happiness.
Which is
a good answer. I don't think I've ever given anybody that answer, and I'm, like, processing that right now as something very sort of powerful. Like, you know, how do we wake people up? Tell them that it's going to be, you know, like going to Hawaii.
Well, again, most people, like I said, I think that's been the future pace that goes on all the time, especially in the summer. For some reason, people are very interested in their future in the summer. And when they're looking out the window and they're seeing, you know, the compiling of all this dreck that's out there, to be able to look within, which is what you're asking them to do, and say, not afterlife, not, you know, the next dimension, here. You can experience it here if you can open up within yourself. Most people are so interested in looking outside and looking for other answers to come to them, and that's why, you know, The Secret, the vision boards, and all the other Ouija stuff that goes on, that basically screws them up worse than if they were still staying hopeless, because at least if they're hopeless, they're not going on, you know, some primrose path that's going to lead them nowhere. They'll just sit still for a while. So in your travels now, looking around at people that are trying desperately to change and looking for answers outside of the normal circle that they would look in, they stumble upon, say, you, what is the first thing you could tell them that, and you're talking about anticipation and expectation, that would get them out of basically fearing things getting different? Because what I see people doing is not so much lining up with – people learn a lot of new stuff, but they don't always apply it. People go out of their way to push themselves outside their comfort zones, but they don't always stay outside their comfort zone. They go right back to them. How do you get
right.
them to kind of get out and stay out? You know,
yeah.
live out there.
Right. Well, the idea is that you know, people come and they have a question of not feeling like they have control over their lives. So they express
mm-hmm.
that they want control, but they don't really. So that's one of the first things that
mm-hmm.
you have to address, is that if you still want to be able to blame external circumstances for where you are in your life, then you don't really want control. The only way that you really want control over your own destiny and your own life and the path of your own soul is if you're willing to recognize that once you have that, once you become conscious, that you won't really be able to blame external experiences because you will be responsible for creating them. And that's one thing I think that becomes really difficult for people, is that they gnash for control.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling like, oh my God, if I could follow this secret, then I could have control over my life. Like you just said, you know.
Right.
But what they don't really want to do is they don't really want to fully accept the responsibility that comes with consciousness. It's actually more like the Matrix than it is like Inception. That
mm-hmm.
the real truth behind the sleeping masses is a lot more like the Matrix, which to me was and I don't focus on movies really, but when it comes to conceptually what was being offered in the Matrix was a kind of a glimpse at a very basic concept of consciousness and unconsciousness. That consciousness creates a kind of limitless potential. Unconsciousness puts you at the intended whim of others. Whether, you know, and socially, I know you can follow me, Mark, with this concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know you can. That's why I can go on a roll with you.
Oh, yeah, go.
I know I can. I could continue and say that intended consciousness of others is government, corporations, religious policy, and things like that. That if you remain asleep, then your life is going to be guided by the intention of someone else. And right now, the intentions of those someone else's is absolutely the larger corporate entity that wants to keep your life as, you know, meaningless as just being a consuming thing. You know, you're just something that consumes, or an obedient sense of the masses. You know, did you see this posting that went around about George Carlin?
Yes.
George Carlin's farewell thing,
yeah.
You know, and he said, you know, it's the American dream because you've got to be asleep to believe it.
Yeah.
Because that's not really what's going on here anymore. It is some kind of a corporate oligarchy, and that the benefit, this is answering your question now
mm-hmm.
and getting back to the point, which is the benefit of consciousness, of waking up, is that you actually do gain control over your own life. And it's very hard. I mean, you know, I work at consciousness all the time, as I'm sure you do too, and I find that in the face of, you know, socially and culturally what we live in, that it's very difficult to, you know, be conscious all the time over what my impulse is to, you know, purchase something, eat something, watch a certain movie. You know, there's always a weighing out, and yet one of my goals is to move as close to consciousness as I can and allow my unconsciousness, you know, when I find myself there, to be okay with that rather than to judge that.
Well, that's the straddling of the line that most people are, they're absolutists about it. Either they live in the woods and they eat, you know, the food that they trap, and it's like, and they never listen to the radio, the television, the newspaper,
right.
They live with it, you know, and they become a little bit, you know, elitist about it, like, oh, I don't have a TV, you know, what? It's like, and then there's the people that just basically stick on the wrestling, and they go to Walmart, and they go to NASCAR, and they're eating a chili dog,
right.
And they're happy, and they're happy as a pig, and
right.
You know what? So
right.
How do you get people to live in the
well,
say happy medium?
Can you believe that there's a certain portion of people that in order for them to accomplish the lesson that they need to learn in this lifetime right now, that their unconsciousness is the path to them achieving that? That's why I started off our conversation by saying that I'm not necessarily a proponent of mass consciousness, that I feel like that can come in waves. People can become conscious. You could see people become conscious of the civil rights movement. They're definitely becoming conscious of gay people and gay rights. They become conscious of certain things. But we have a lot of war right now, and that's not in the media. People don't want to be conscious of what war really is. We reject that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So we have things like huge oil spill disasters that are designed to make us conscious of our oil use and our oil needs, and that this is part of the price that we pay for that, is the disaster, natural disaster. And yet, again, you find that people tune it out. I mean, I'm assuming that you're on the East Coast, and, you know, I lived in Greenwich Village at the time of 9/11. Don't bring this up very often, but
mm-hmm.
I lived in Greenwich Village. I was out on Hudson Street. I watched it. I watched the buildings fall, the whole bit. And people in New York were conscious. All the entire city of New York City, every borough and every person that lived there, I would say 99%, there was probably 1% who was just too bitter to realize what was going on. But 99% of the city became polite, friendly, loving, and awake. Their own individual lives became less important to them than this massive thing that had happened in their environment. And consciousness was created in, you know, 10, 20, or more, obviously, more people lived outside of there. But within my environment in Manhattan, and I felt 10 million people wake up for 48 hours before
yes.
they started pushing each other out of
the
way in the subway again.
Yeah. I remember that experience because it was like, you know, being a practitioner up here, people were calling me on their cell phone that morning all
right.
over. They had all ran from Wall Street down to the South Street Seaport, and some of them went the other way and got on ferries, and they were calling. They were hitting any button they could, and they
right.
had me on speed dial to get a message out to tell their family they were okay. And I must have handled,
right.
I don't even know, 100 phone calls that day, taking messages and looking at people, you know,
yep.
basically star 69, who the heck was this person, cross-reference that. And so I was like Larry King, like, who are you, you know? And I remember the wave of connectedness that kind of fell on us that Wednesday and Thursday after the attacks, where you just went out in the street, total strangers were just so cooperative, and everyone had that kind of
right.
hazy glow on them.
Right.
And then the first sign of looting, the first sign of something weird happening, it all evaporated by the end of that week, and you really were in this coldness, this darkness, this...
Well, back to business
kind of,
as usual.
Yeah, but it was
you know?
It was colder than normal. It was even more impersonal.
Well, I mean, you
and
know, when you talk
anyway,
about, you know, greed and money and everyone feeling
yeah.
unsafe, you know,
and
people feel
unsafe.
Next,
yeah, we were
right.
all waiting for the next wave of it, and then a month later we had the anthrax attack, and people are throwing Parmesan cheese on the train. People are jumping off the train in Mount Vernon. And, yeah, it did get back to business as usual. You're right. That's why when we had the Times Square thing a couple months ago here, it was like a one-day story. We're right back to normal, you know. We become sort of, like I said, I started the show with comfortably numb. And,
right.
I saw a quote on Twitter a couple days ago. Maybe it was last night. Someone was bemoaning on Awareness Radio, another blog talk radio show here, about
yep.
how when he was younger. You familiar with him? They're on all the time.
No, I just know. I know that there's a lot of shows I'm listening.
Yeah, Awareness Radio is pretty. They have a lot of weird guys.
Yeah.
So, he's on there. chit-chatting with someone on Twitter, and someone said to him, you know, when I was younger, you know, life was less complicated, and his response was, well, maybe you were less complicated. And when you think about it, most of our lives become, as we age, we are constantly adding more information, but we're not organized inside. So instead of becoming more complex and more organized, we get more complicated and we break down. And because of the fact that you're dealing with so many conflicting beliefs and so many rival stories and all these different maps, I think most people at a certain point just tune out. And you're right, they do go into that sort of a numbness that doesn't allow them to go on that path. So,
right.
So they get
so. But now we'll talk about the World Trade Center and it falling. And of all of those people, how many of them remained somewhat conscious? If 99% of people became conscious for 24 to 48 hours and then the door closed, how many of them remained somewhat conscious after that? What if it was a half of 1%? Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Yeah, well, I still say, like, a lot of times when you face mortality like that and you face, you know, that sudden, that how fragile we are, I've seen people survive, you know, car crashes, plane crashes, things like that, and they become almost nirvana-like in the way that they process things because
they're not as exactly. Most people closed the door and went back to business as usual. They didn't really allow that event to really change them, and our government encouraged it, right? I mean, the mayor and the president were out saying the very best thing we could do was go shopping. That was the very best thing that we could do to support the people of New York was to keep spending. And there was no really greater message than that about what had happened to us. We should be angry, we should be hurt, we should retaliate, and we should not stop spending. There was no greater spiritual message for the masses.
That was it. That was the guidance.
Right.
And we're going to find bin Laden and...
and yet there are individuals, though, that came to you, that came to me. My practice was also quite full that day with people who were very lost and, you know, didn't know where to go. And they had me on their phone also, and they dialed. And they were like, hey, can I come over? And I was like, sure, you know. My office was open, and people came.
Yeah.
And it was fine. It was good. The subways were down, and so people were in my office that day. And I went to the deli on the corner and got food, and we all had a kind of morose afternoon where I actually unplugged the television because it was too much. And I was like, you know, we don't really need to watch the TV, so we had it on the radio. And we were just listening to reports of when the subway would open, and that was it. People went home after that, but in the evening. But your questioning today about consciousness and what's going on in the world and what can we expect energetically from this time is a topic that interests me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And to
kind of throw a little circle around this, because I had my own experiences that day. I was here till 2 o'clock in the morning. I had people basically sitting in my waiting room just kind of hanging out just because they didn't want to leave that space. It was a safe space to be, and I just kept working.
Right.
I had people coming back and forth all night. Is that once you're touched by an event like that, because it's so overwhelming and so all-consuming and you can't escape it, you can't shut it off, you know, it's almost 10 years. Next year it'll be 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a big chunk of time. It blew my mind a couple months ago. We had a 10th anniversary of something that happened. I forget which attack it was. Some weird. It was like, I can't believe that was 10 years ago already. As we get to the point where we're not switching maps all the time, we're not competing with maps, which ideology is going to dominate, you know, whether it's political or religious or whatever. Once we get to the point where we can actually perceive the whole, will the communication become much more interpersonal or intrapersonal? Will the conversation begin more inside us, or will the conversation begin more between us? I always wait for something to tell me the 100th monkey is on the beach. I don't know if he's still out there lost at sea, but if we're going to wake up all these people at once, you know, whether it's 2012 and you know, everything, the skies turn to fire, or it's this drip, 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 like a BP spill and things like that, and it's like, wake up, wake up, wake up.
Yeah.
Is Gaia gonna tell us, or are we gonna basically become better Earthlings and do it on our own? I'm trying to look for a kind of divining rod here to figure out how we're gonna govern that, because as more people become part of the fold that we're talking about, that accept
right.
and move through rather than deny and move away.
One of the big questions is it happening fast enough? You know, several great thinking minds and scientists have said in the last couple of months it's not, and that we're not going to be able to prevent cataclysmic event from happening in the next 100 years. So, you know, when somebody asks me the other day about the meaning of it all, a client asked me, and you know, very existentially, like, but does it really matter? And I said, yes, it matters, because each individual and the growth of their soul, the spiritual growth of their soul, in the struggle to be more compassionate, more charitable, more understanding, more compromising, more fair, the individual growth of that soul in choosing love is what that boils down to, you know, choosing love over our own individual ego needs, which is the huge experience of being in the body. It's a very, you know, ego needs driven experience. In choosing love, we grow. And each individual that's choosing love is growing, and that's all that matters. It doesn't matter what other external thing is really happening. We can go to people like you or me or listen to this type of show and maybe wake up and walk away from it a little bit more awake and say, oh, like, okay, choose love a little bit more. Choose compassion. Choose honesty. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to do because, it, like you said, it's counterintuitive to the human experience.
Yeah, well, people feel like
I want to eat now. I want to eat now. I want to sleep now. I want to get laid now. I want to have it my way right now. That's the human experience. It's accommodating the needs of the body all the time and, you know, our individual personality and ego-based consciousness. There's something that's really important about that, because this is a, you know, an experiment in the physical plane. Something really, there's something really beautiful about having an ego-based consciousness, and it causes us to create. That's why that exists, and yet it also often prevents us from choosing love and growing at a soul-based level. And so I don't have an existential belief that it's meaningless, because whether in 2012 the sky fills with fire or not, the each person along the way that you and I are talking to, that you and I are waking up a little bit in their own way, who choose love a little bit more in their day-to-day life with the people that they meet and with themselves, critically important. You have to choose loving yourself.
So let's deal with one topic here that comes up a lot when people go through this door, because I see it a lot more with people coming up from memory than anything else, is feelings that pull them back to the past and their lower selves, whether it's guilt, shame, regret, sadness, loss, attachment, all that earthbound gunk that pulls them back into relationships where they felt powerless or overwhelmed or abused or neglected, or their needs weren't met, or they're emotionally abandoned, or whatever the
right.
whatever the label is. I mean, they all, it all comes up. And I always smile at them when they bring that up, and I just say, exhale. It's like,
right.
It's like not getting off the swing at the park. It's like, I'm going to stop swinging. I'm going to sit here. I'm done swinging, but I'm not going to get off the swing.
Right.
Because
how do we resolve the past?
Yeah, well, as long as you hang in it, it doesn't move.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I have a few thoughts about why it's so difficult to get off the swing. You know, I do believe, because my work right now is exclusively working with clients and from a spiritual place working with their emotional needs and a lot of the things that have happened to them and conditioned behavior patterns. That's what that is. It's a conditioned childhood behavior pattern, that swing that you're talking about. And it's very hard to get off of that because we don't really know what a better behavior pattern would be. We don't know how to react to the world in a different way because we learned how to react to it in a specific way when we were younger, and it very much got ingrained in us that way. So if someone was abused, and they feel very frightened by the world, it's very difficult to unwind that fearful, conditioned emotional response because mm-hmm. there's a cellular memory, as I'm sure you're very familiar with doing mm-hmm. body work, that the actual body remembers abuse patterns. You know, if you got, like, you know, the crap beat out of you every day by your mother or father, then if somebody even, like, raises their voice to you, you could shut down. A lot of times it's very hard for people to unwind those emotional patterns. I believe it's possible. I believe that consciousness can do that. I believe that we can let go of the past, you know, resolve the past. That's what I had said better before when you brought this topic up. I said that yeah. I felt you wanted to have a little conversation about resolution of past trauma. And I believe it's possible, but it takes a great deal of consciousness. And people, you know, do have a lot of denial mechanisms. There are a lot of defense mechanisms in place that are surrounding the conditioned emotional response. And defense mechanisms are there because they protect us from further experiencing more trauma. So, the whole idea of breaking through and waking people up, and like you said, it's a great topic. All kinds of bad experiences from the past can prevent conscious awakening. Absolutely. So it needs to be handled, I think, in a very gentle way. People can start by saying to themselves, "Gee, I wonder if there are any things in my past that I'm not fully honest about, I'm not fully aware of, or that I'm holding on to for one reason or another." You know, just questioning it is a great place to start. You know, like you say, somebody could say, like, "I feel like I'm afraid of saying I love you." All right, well, why? Why do you feel that way? You know, I'm just throwing out an example. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a part of a conditioned childhood behavior pattern. And then if you were to say, "Well, it was not encouraged in my family. My mother never told me that. My father never told me that. They were both very cold, and so I can't really say that because when I would say it, they rejected me." All right, that's good. You know, how can we, like, deal with the hurt that created and then become who we want to be today as opposed to feeling like we're stuck? That's why I said it was about resolution. It's about resolving, figuring out how to honor the fact that happened to us and then, you know, be able to overcome it in some way. Okay. It's not easy.
No. I mean, like I said, if it was easy, we wouldn't have to do the show. Everyone would just do it automatically. But we haven't conditioned ourselves as spiritual, from a spiritual perspective. And I'm not talking, you know, from a religious practice or some higher consciousness, just to have that reference point, that cosmic reference point, and, you know, we're going to segue into a couple of these maps that you've been able to kind of wrestle down a little bit in a second here. But looking at it from just a kind of recap and everything, we're talking with Dr. Craig Martin from LAHealer.com, summertime, 10:08 on the East Coast. I just kind of do a time check weather. Let's see, it's 76 degrees here in New York and partly cloudy everywhere. When people take a look at their experiences and try to dissect them, they usually go through it from the standpoint of, it's almost like they get the play-by-play of what happened. They give me an event, you know, okay, this happened, my mother-in-law said this, it triggered that, da 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 da. And then they give the color commentary, which is, their, like you said, that ego kind of shading, because the bias is always to get back to a safe point, safe place.
Right.
And what I see happening is people don't understand that that's a half step. it's like the Go in Monopoly. You get 200 points, you know, $200 for passing Go. But where, what direction are you going? People don't have that inner guidance, so they tend to circle around, and then they boom, and they sit still. And what I see is that if you look at consciousness more phasic and less temporal, more rhythmic and less linear, you can let both sides of the wave have a voice here. So I always give them the analogy, and I think it might have been you that told me about this, is that if you think of consciousness in terms of, like you take an ice cube, right, and here's the solid part, right, that you see as earth, and it's there, and it's literal, and it's always there for you, and those are your actions, everyday actions. You can physically express yourself. It's external. It's there, right? Then it becomes water, right, and you say, okay, well, now it's fluid. Now that's memory. That's the emotions. That's the oceans. That's the tides. That has a little more activity to it, but you can't put a fork in it anymore. It becomes more something that can embody things, but you can't literally put it, you have to put a container around it in order to find out what it is. And then it evaporates, and now it's supposedly gone, but it's in the air, and it has that essence to it. And that's the spiritual realm. So when you think of yourself, your own consciousness as a human being, you have that essence, you have that emotional like fluidity, and you have that solid presence. And if you can combine all three of those and be rhythmic and be phasic and move through those different windows, you can actually be conscious of all three at the same time rather than being separate from you or like three different channels on a TV. They're all you at the same time. They're all basically different expressions of you, and then you can move through them, through your experiences and start to shift the way that you're going to approach an experience. And most people have a hammer for every problem becomes a nail, and that gets into these habits you're talking about, those ingrained habits. So shifting people out of that, I use the four domains, from somatic organization,
right,
orientation, to that as you move through those first 4 years of life, it's almost like moving through four different perspectives. So the first stop on the train is always about bonding. It's always about me and my species, me and my parents, you know. And that relationship one is the biggest hook. It's most of our nervous systems are hooked in by relationships. That's why, you know, your book's about that. And it creates a foundation for us to have a healthy life with other people, right? Then the second year, you go terrible too, and you go, no, all about me. That's that ego part that tries to separate. From 80% of us are locked into that battle most of our lives. It's either us or them, us or them. And that's every therapy session, as every trip to the lawyer, trip to the priest, you know, it's always us or them. The third one is the one that I actually kind of specialize in, is that emotional layer that deals with the surroundings. So you have us or them, then you have that circle around it. Like you look at the yin-yang, and then you say, okay, what's that circle around the yin-yang? What's that setting that polarization is taking place in? Because if it's the same setting, it doesn't matter if you move to Timbuktu, you're going to find those people and attract that same cast of characters again and again and again, and you go through it over and over until you figure out to change the environment, right? Then the fourth step is to take all three of those lessons and come up with an external way to notice it so that it becomes something that's exosomatic that you can put into structure so that you can break it down and put it back together and become competent in all four phases of it so that you don't have to repeat it again. Most people are so, you know, like I said, they're so other than conscious about the fact that these patterns have repeated over and over again. That's how it got ingrained. And getting to novelty and not naming it and not trying to land that, you know, everything that comes across, I think that's where the consciousness has to shift. That's where I see it going into kind of that lazy pattern of just putting things back on the shelf rather than breaking it down from a standpoint of how do I interact with this and being almost kind of flexible with the way you're going to interpret it. Let me feel it. Let me taste it. Let me walk around with it. Let me not name it. Let not get your head involved with it right away. Because once you pin the tail on it, whatever it is, it sort of makes it inert. You can't change it anymore. You put a label on it, and at that point, it has more power over you than anything, because now that thing is going to sit next to all the things that are similar to it, all the things that are different to it, you know, and it becomes a big cluster. So with your work and dealing with people, how people use this in relationships, you know, and in case you guys aren't aware, Dr. Martin has scribbled this down for you in a little book called, scroll up here.
Elemental Love Style.
Elemental Love Style. There it is. Finding compatibility and creating a lasting relationship. Now, four elements. Now, I had this argument this afternoon with the client. Chinese system, five elements, right?
Right.
Okay, so for you guys uninitiated, you moose, putting an ear to this, wood, which is liver, gallbladder, fire, which is small intestine, heart, triple warmer, and what's the other one? Adrenals, pericardium. And then earth elements, spleen, stomach, and pancreas, my favorite. And then you got metal element, which is the lung, large intestine, which is kind of like air. And then you got water, kidneys, and bladder. Now, all of that deals with nature, macrocosm, microcosm, right? That's the five-element theory.
Right.
And those things go around like a star in a circle, and they do all their little dance. The original four elements, which is not that map, is the one you're talking about more, right, which is earth, fire, water, and air.
Right.
Right. Now, there used to be a fifth element, it's like the fifth beetle, ether, right?
Right.
Which was the one that got kind of lost in the Western model, because we like foursies in the Western model.
Right.
And so we kind of, because
and the Asian and the Chinese don't.
No.
You know that too, right? They
yeah.
four the Ichi Ni San Chi, that four means death.
Yeah.
So in China, nothing is ever in fours.
Four is the end for them. Four is like is basically like it's almost like an inert point, because it means
correct.
To them that nothing can change. It's like gridlock.
It makes
and
it
of course,
square, exactly.
And,
it's rigidity.
And that's why we're structure and they're function. We're much more into the external. We like fours. We like squares. You know, they like circles. It's like, and that orientation is so ingrained in us archetypally that our maps have that reflect that. So it's like
right.
We took the ether out.
Right.
By taking the ether out of those four elements, we took the spirituality out of the elements. We made them into
right.
material form.
In a sense, we did, except that, like in my book, I tried to write the spirituality back into each one of them. Which
well, that's
is
the
that
point.
You,
ether is in each one of them. It's embedded.
Right.
So it becomes the implicit or the tacit element in
right.
these four explicit elements that everyone can notice, everyone can experience. So,
right. I mean, in like Native American culture, there are four directions, and then there's
right.
the center. So the
yeah.
fifth thing is the center.
It's
there's
the circle
four,
around the
you know.
It's, yeah.
If there's north, south, east, and west, there's also where you're standing.
That's the thing. Everyone forgets the observer, because everyone focuses on the map and not the people that's reading the map. In my world, it's like you have the four domains, those four orientations, and then you move through the somatic circle. So you're always referencing yourself in that domain-based environment that gives you perspective.
Right.
So in this map, in the one you're talking about here, and just trying to relate it to somatics for a minute, the air element is the people that deal with it. They're thinkers. They prioritize communication.
It's the mind, right, yep.
Yeah, it's more mental. The earth people are more practical and grounded, which makes sense. The water is emotion, intuition, very much like the Chinese map. And then the fire one is creative, enthusiastic. Now, those are archetypal. You could go through a zillion cultures. You're going to find those four themes almost everywhere. Now,
right.
I tried to plug that into those domains, and those damn domains are squirrely. Because they mix and match a lot of stuff.
Right.
From a philo perspective, because it's about communication.
But in your four domains, you see species bonding. That first one is identity, which is fire.
Okay.
Fire is about identity. And, you know, I feel almost like it would kind of almost go like those first four signs in astrology, which is Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer.
Okay.
Because Aries gives you your identity, Taurus gives you your separation, us and them, you know, the body, and then Gemini gives a description, which is, you know, the environment and how you describe it, and then Cancer, which is the emotional realm, gives you the external way of feeling your environment. So it could be a little bit that's the other way around, like the environment could be a little more watery. I think you said it was an emotional response.
Yeah, well, that's
the third left.
When I looked at it before, I'm saying to myself, when I plugged it in, I saw communication, that's philo to me. But that would be air. But I'm saying that they're not thinking, they're babies, you know. So it's like,
yeah,
well,
it's fire. Fire, because fire
yeah.
is a fire is definitely about your identity as well. Because it's like there's a motivation for self-awareness. There's that whole creative process of realizing that you've come into being. That's fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that, again, looking at this map, air is metal in the Chinese map, so that's why I looked at it kind of funny, and I said, well, I don't know. If you go one way above it, you go ether, and you go to spirituality. You go one way below it, you add the wood element, which is birth energy, which goes back to Philo. So I'd have to play with this map a little bit more to understand how it all interacts, but what my point was looking at it was that it's that foursies thing, is that we're in an attempt to get structure over something that's like consciousness and something that's the cosmos that's so much bigger and better than us in terms of its information quantity. We can reduce things down to something that's as portable as this. Now, for me, it's the domains. For you, it's these things. If people meet each other and see elements in each other like this,
right,
it's much, much easier to nominalize those behaviors than it is to label people like they do in psychology, where you're introverted, you're extroverted, you're this, you're that.
Right.
And it becomes characteristic of you rather than elemental to you. And when it's elemental, it's not such a bad deal. It's like...
Well, we all have all four of the elements as a part
right.
of our personality. I mean, they're just descriptions of personality qualities. You know, like I always say, we all have a passionate, intellectual, emotional, and practical nature.
Mm-hmm.
We all do. So we all have some fire. We all have some enthusiasm. We all have a brain, you know, some air. We all have emotional reaction to the world around us. And we also all have practical needs, which is the earth. So
and
the elements are just...
all four.
Yeah, relationships, but our personalities do. Our personalities function on a pan-elemental basis. So I think it's important to recognize that when we're interacting with other people, what we recognize in them is some people have more of a preponderance of a way of behaving. They, you know, and this is only one part also of the way that I'm viewing people. I teach elemental, like an elemental psychology to people and helping them to become more conscious, because you have to create more simplistic views for people so that they can, you know, understand it. It's, you know, when we talk about, I know it's one of the great struggles for helping people wake up, but if it doesn't come from a very simplified, palatable, and easy-to-digest method, you know, it's not going to be easy for people to understand. They're going to turn their back on it. They barely have time to, you know, like, stay for 10 seconds on one website. They're off doing something else, you know?
There's a thing that's called, it's the YouTube attention span. It used to be that... that YouTube videos were 10 minutes long. That was
now
we don't even have an attention span for that. If it takes 10 minutes, it's like we're I can't believe this is 10 minutes long.
Oh, we don't have 10 minutes for anything.
No. So we've become so impatient to get a message. You almost have to literally grab two beers, open a plane, and jump out and slide down, or have a big argument on a security camera with McDonald's to get anyone's attention. So there was a cute thing on, and even that.
Oh,
it passes through. It's gone. It's here and gone. It doesn't stop.
Right, because the guy jumping out of the airplane, his whole message is that, you know, he's fed up with being treated poorly.
Right.
That's his whole message.
Yeah.
Not the focus in the media has not been about, you know, are we justified in acting out and saying, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to let you treat me like this anymore? You know, that's what his beef was. He didn't want to be treated that way anymore, and the media is turning it into, this is a part of the drama with the airlines. Come on, you people. This has been going on at the post office for the last 40 years.
Yeah, they've complained. Again, this is that corporate thing where, oh, look at this little cog. You know, what's wrong with this little cog? You know,
yeah.
And instead of looking at it as a reflection of our global consciousness coming
correct.
Out of this one person.
Well, you know how that is, Mark,
the
right?
No,
I mean, you
know
how that is. It's not, you know, and we're struggling with that now because the stakes are so high. The stakes are so high for humanity. To wake up a little bit. And you know, and yet, like I say, regardless of those stakes, the importance is in waking up ourselves, in choosing to wake up ourselves, not because there is no way to wake up people who don't want to be woken up. Mm-hmm. So the choice has to be, don't you want to wake up? You know, waking up has its benefits. It certainly is going to benefit the planet and humanity. So maybe we should. And yet I still understand that most people, that's not what they're really here for. They're not here to wake up. It's not the lesson that they're here to be learning, you know. They're here doing much more low-level. They could be here doing territorial disputes as gang members in central Los Angeles, right? I mean, that's very, you know, basic experience, right, on the earth. So it's a very basic experience, how to put food on my table, period. That's it. That's like the experience. How do I go and get make enough money to make sure that I can eat three meals a day? That's better than being born in a country where you're like just like a starving person who doesn't even know how to do that.
And I said it, again, it's all relative. If you're sitting under a mudslide right now in China,
correct.
You know, your reference point for what we're saying is going to be a lot different than somebody who, you know, was on that plane. You know,
right.
And
yet there are still a lot of people who are in a position. I think this is a part of what it is that you're trying to say, which is that there are still a lot of people who are in a position in their lives and in the karmic life that they're living with the, you know, the luxuries and benefits that they have in their lives, that they could wake up a little more. They could stand to wake up a little more. And the way that they treat themselves and the way that they treat others and the way that they, you know, the way that they allow themselves to operate, you know, on the planet, that they could wake up a little more. And that's all I would hope for, you know, in doing a radio interview and talking to people and doing lectures and meeting people and working with my individual clients and in writing a book. That was all I ever, you know, could hope for, was that some people would wake up just a little bit more. They would choose to wake up a little bit more.
Well, I think you've done a yeoman's job getting us started tonight. Gave us a lot of things to think about. And
You're awesome. I love having a conversation with you. You know, you're right there, you know. You can totally meet at that, you know, that higher place. When are you coming to Los Angeles?
Well, get me out there. I'll talk. Whatever you want me to do. Come on. I'm up for a flight. L.A. Hasn't handled me yet. I mean, I've been as far west as Colorado with this stuff and got stuck in Soma Valley out there in Denver. But I'd love to go out there to mix maps with you guys because I really think that's the next step as far as getting – and that's why, you know, I might as well mention it. We're having the Coherence Conference here in October over in Bridgeport to try to bring together people from all different disciplines. You can go check it out on the site at somaspace.org. Definitely would love to have your contribution to that because cosmic coherence from you, and then we get some of the physicists to talk, that's a party. I think it would be interesting to see how that all mixed together. But really, great stuff, and I appreciate you coming on short notice tonight. And
not a problem. I was glad that I was available.
Yeah, we all kind of jive together. So as a parting gift, what would you give to everybody out there looking out the window tonight, ready to jump out of it?
As a parting thing, we do have something going on right now all year, all next year, that in astrology is called a cardinal grand square, a cardinal grand cross. And it means that there are planets in Cancer, Aries, Libra, and Capricorn, and they are. So they're forming a giant box, a square, around the Earth. And those planets are Pluto and Capricorn, and then particularly in Aries, we have Uranus and Jupiter, and then we have Saturn in Libra, and then the big players in Cancer are really going to be Mars, the Sun, the Moon. Those are the planets that are there. What does that mean? What does a cardinal grand square mean? It's a function of the individual's presence. Who am I as an individual in relationship to they're the major points of life, really. Who am I as an individual? It actually connects, I think, with your, you know, with the somatic thing. Who am I as an individual, which is Aries, connected to the family, which is Cancer, connected to my primary relationships, which is Libra, connected to society. which is Capricorn, and how, because it's a conflict. We always have a conflict. The individual coming up against the family, the personal relationship, and also society, is that the individual has to learn how to conform. Then also that the family or the marriage relationship or society may try to over-conform you, and then the individual has to fight back. So the balance between those four quadrants, which are the four most important quadrants in astrological, what you call the cosmic theory, I love that. Those four quadrants are the most important of all of the things that we're about to go through. It's a renegotiation of the family, primary relationships, our relationship to society, and the individual, all in conflict slash harmony. And how do we go between conflict and harmony? And you can see it. The guy that jumped out of the plane expressed his individuality in response to an individual relationship with that woman that hit him in the head, and society at large, which was everyone else on the plane as well as the airline in general. Then he went down the slide with his bags and he went home to his primary relationship. So it happened right there, and it's happening over and over again, is that it's the broader context of the struggle to be an individual in a larger world.
Well, thanks for that little kind of a cosmic telescope to help us read between the lines and maybe read between the T, the M, and the Z. So I wish you a great summer, and hopefully we'll interact again real soon. And
thanks,
we'll
Mark. Anytime.
Thanks for everything. They were great tonight.
Bye-bye.
Take care. All right, everybody, you've gotten your instructions. So I wanted to wish you guys a nice little Philo weekend, you know, just shake hands, be nice, come out swinging next week as we go to the Hunto side of the wave next week on Soma Time. So for everybody here, Dr. Craig Martin from LAHealer.com, I'm Dr. Mark, travel light through the darkness. Little Tom Petty, take us out, baby.
Eddie waited till he finished high school. He went to Hollywood, got a tattoo. He met a girl out there with a tattoo too. The future was wide open. They'd moved into a place they both could. She had a guitar and she taught him some chords. The sky was the limit. Into the great wide open, under the skies of blue.
Spiral on, sapiens. God save the Mets.